You're listening to IRIS, the Iowa Radio Reading Information Service for the Blind and Print Handicapped. Welcome to the reading of Council Bluffs Daily Nonpareil for Friday, October 23rd. I'm Miles from Drake University. Here is our first story. Iowa's use of pandemic aid for the second IT project draws scrutiny. Iowa City, Iowa, is planning to use millions of dollars in federal pandemic relief funds on a long-term plan to improve data management across state agencies. A second information technology project that may not fit the intended purpose of the aid. State and federal auditors this week told Iowa's executive branch to return millions of dollars to the state's $1.25 billion coronavirus relief fund that they have spent on a new accounting and human resources computer system. They determined the project championed by Governor Kim Reynolds was not an appropriate expense, noting that a $20 million contract with the vendor was signed before the coronavirus emerged. A state report shows that the same agency responsible for that project, the Office of the Chief Information Officer, has been given $16.9 million in federal pandemic relief funds for a second technology initiative that was under discussion before COVID-19. In its strategic plan drafted last year, the officer said it would adopt a master data management strategy to standardize how agencies collect information about their customers so data sets can be more easily compared and analyzed. By bringing the state's various data sources together, constituent agencies can gain a more holistic understanding of the needs of Iowans today and in the future, said the officer of the plan. So far, it has spent about $40,000 on the project out of $16.9 million in coronavirus relief funds set aside to the date by the Iowa Department of Management. As part of the project, the state last month selected Sensible Corp for a five-year multi-million dollar contract to create and install a new cloud-based data management platform. The state will have the option of extending the deal with St. Louis-based Sense for up to five more years. The state's 128-page request for proposals issued to vendors in July mentioned the coronavirus once, saying the contract's first work stream will focus on critical data during emergent situations like the COVID-19 pandemic. The initial goal is to align how six agencies, the Department of Public Health, Human Services, Revenue, Education, Corrections, and Workforce Development, collect customer data. The vendor must then determine how to use the data to provide insights and understanding for these agencies and the populations they serve. The office provided vendors with one high-level example of how a central data hub might work. For instance, a search could help the Department of Revenue seek out addresses for taxpayers it is trying to learn or find whether they have died. Democrats have raised concerns about the governor's use of coronavirus relief for technology projects at a time when Iowa's deaths, hospitalizations, and infection rates are skyrocketing. They have argued the money could be spent on any number of clearly allowable expenses, such as expanding testing and contact tracing, purchasing personal protective equipment, and providing aid for struggling workers and businesses. Iowa has spent $21 million from the fund on an eviction and foreclosure prevention program, about half as much that has been set aside for the two information technology projects. Senator Claire Kelsey, a West Des Moines Democrat, said Thursday that the governor's staff haven't briefed key lawmakers on the data management project, and that it's unclear whether it will be considered a qualifying expense for pandemic funds. If they can explain why they need it and how it's going to benefit the pandemic, we'll have no problem with it. But doing an end run around the regular process is problematic, she said. The concern, obviously, is something being done wrong. We'll have to pay it back. Multiple state officials haven't responded to inquiries about the data project this week. The governor said Wednesday that her administration believes the workday human resources and accounting system is an allowable expense, saying it will contest a determination by Treasury Department Deputy Inspector General Richard Delmar that it does not qualify. Reynolds said the state would use the funds for a different purpose if the appeal is rejected. Federal pandemic funds may be used only to cover costs that are necessary to respond to the public health emergency and were not accounted for in a previous budget. The Workday project does not meet either of those criteria because the upgrade was planned and budgeted before the pandemic and isn't necessary to address it, Delmar wrote. State Auditor Rob Sand reached the same conclusion. Unlike Workday, the data management project was not funded by the governor in this year's state budget, but it is not clear whether the project will be deemed unnecessary or necessary to respond to the pandemic. Metro area hospitals see high number of COVID-19 patients. Area hospitals continue to see a high number of COVID-19 patients. The Metro Omaha Healthcare Coalition reported 176 inpatients diagnosed with COVID-19 on Thursday, with 59 confirmed and 5 suspected to have the disease in intensive care, and about 40 area residents suspected of having the disease are waiting results. 14 COVID-19 patients in the Metro are on a ventilator, the coalition reported. Methodist CHI Health and Nebraska Medicine are among the more than 10 healthcare organizations that make up Healthcare Coalition. The coalition reported 82% of inpatient medical surgical beds were in use, with intensive care units at 74% occupancy. Pediatrics ICUs were 68% occupied. That's not unusual, Dudley County, Nebraska Health Department Director Adi Poor said, as reported by the Omaha World Herald, as hospitals prefer to be full. I think the message is every fifth ICU bed is occupied by a COVID-19 patient, and every 10th general hospital bed is occupied by a COVID-19 patient, Poor said. In Iowa Regional Medical Coordination Center, Region 4, which includes Pottawatomie, Mills, Harrison, Cass, Crawford, Shelby, Fremont, Montgomery, Page, Adams, Auburn, and Taylor counties, there were 45 COVID-19 patients, with 13 in intensive care, according to the Iowa Department of Public Health COVID-19 website. Those hospital numbers include some overlap with the coalition's numbers. The state site listed 176 inpatient beds, 15 available ICU beds, and 58 available ventilators, with one patient on a ventilator. Pottawatomie County Public Health Director Matt Wyant said Thursday there were about 20 COVID-19 patients at the two hospitals in Council Bluffs. They're higher than where they have been, Wyant said. Uptick. The state listed 68 positive cases in the county over a 24-hour period, with a total of 3,081 out of 25,937 tests at 3 p.m. on Thursday. There were 237 new tests. The county's 14-day rolling average positivity rate remains steady at 12.3%. The rate was hovering around 10% at the start of the month. I'm happy that it's not going any higher than that. But we're treading a little bit in the wrong direction, Wyant said. We're always looking for ways to lower our numbers. Wyant said during the pandemic, Southwest Iowa has generally been 3 to 4 weeks behind Central and Eastern Iowa when it comes to trends. Those increased case counts are making their way over to the other side of the state, along with the Douglas and Cass, Nebraska counties, Wyant said, noting that in October, adults in the 35 to 50 years old age range have made up about 30% of new cases. Our younger demographics, being back in school wearing face coverings, have lowered our numbers, Wyant said. I think it's evident enough to show face coverings do the work. It's just about getting those 35 to 50 age range to buy into masks. Statewide, Iowa listed 18 new deaths and 1,491 new cases over 24 hours on Thursday afternoon. About half of those who died were in long-term care facilities, the Associated Press reported. The state reported 530 were being transported in Iowa hospitals for the virus, down slightly from the 535 people hospitalized on Wednesday. U.S. health officials Wednesday redefined what counts as close contact with somebody with COVID-19 to include briefer but repeated encounters, the Associated Press reported. For months, the Centers for Disease Control and Prevention said close contact meant spending a total of 15 minutes within 6 feet of somebody who tested positive for coronavirus. On Wednesday, the CDC changed it to a total of 15 minutes, or more. So shorter, but repeated contacts that added up to 15 minutes over a 24-hour period now count. The CDC advises anyone who has been in close contact with a COVID-19 patient to quarantine for 2 weeks. The change may prompt health departments to do contact tracing in cases where an exposure might previously have been considered too brief, said Dr. William Schaffner, a Vanderbilt University infectious disease expert. It also serves notice that the coronavirus can spread more easily than many people realize, he added. The definition change was triggered by a report on the case that of a 20-year-old Vermont correctional officer who was diagnosed with a coronavirus infection in August. The guard, who wore a mask and goggles, had multiple brief encounters with 6 transferred prisoners who, before test results, they should were positive. At times, the prisoners wore masks. There were no encounters in cell doorways or in a recreational room where prisoners did not have them on, the report said. An investigation that reviewed video footage concluded the guards' brief interactions totaled 17 minutes during an 8-hour shift. The report didn't identify the prison, but Vermont officials have said in late July, 6 inmates tested positive when they arrived at the Marble Valley Correctional Facility in Rutland. In a statement, CDC officials said the case highlights again the importance of wearing masks to prevent transmission, and that the agency's guidance can change as new information comes in. As we get more data and understand this COVID, we're going to continue to incorporate that in our recommendations, CDC Director Robert Redfield said at a press conference in Atlanta. Court ruling could block thousands of Iowa ballot requests. Iowa City. A split Iowa Supreme Court on Wednesday upheld a new Republican-backed law that would bar county election commissioners from mailing absentee ballots to thousands of people who omitted information on their applications. The 4-3 ruling meant that voters who want to cast mail-in ballots into the November 3rd election must complete their absentee ballot applications before Saturday's deadline in order to qualify. Auditors will not be allowed to use the state's voter registration system to fix any deficient applications, as they have done in prior elections. Voters must do so themselves. Dissenting justices said the ruling will likely cause thousands of voters to not receive their ballot in time to use it, and others will face increased health risks from voting in person during the pandemic. Those affected who would still be able to vote early at the auditor's office in satellite locations or on election day. The ruling marks another legal victory for Republicans in Donald Trump's re-election campaign in Iowa, where his race against Democrat Joe Biden and key Senate contests are expected to be close. Republicans who control the Iowa legislature passed the law in June after the primaries saw record turnout with heavy mail-in voting, which was promoted as a way to keep people from contracting coronavirus at crowded polling places. The law specified that auditors cannot use government databases to fill in blanks on absentee request forms and must contact voters by email, phone, and mail to provide the information. Auditors say that the task is time-consuming and not always successful. Under Iowa's voter identification law, those applying for absentee ballots must provide either a driver's license number or their voter PIN number, which few people know. Auditors say some requesters leave the field blank or make other mistakes or omissions on the forms. Critics contend the law adds several days of processing incomplete requests and that thousands of them could be left without absentee ballots. The League of United Latin American Citizens of Iowa and Majority Forward, a group supporting Senate Democrats, filed a lawsuit in July claiming the law was an unconstitutional burden on the right to vote that could prevent some people from participating this year. Trump's campaign and Republican groups intervened, arguing the law was necessary to protect election integrity. The Supreme Court agreed last week to review the decision. On the same day, the court upheld a directive from Secretary of State Paul Pate, a Republican, that invalidated tens of thousands of absentee ballot applications that have been sent to voters in 3 counties with their identification information already filled in. In the majority opinion Wednesday, 4 justices agreed with Republicans that the law was a way to protect the integrity and security of absentee ballot system by requiring requesters to provide information verifying their identities. We are not persuaded the statute imposes a significant burden on absentee voters. It is not a direct burden on voting itself, wrote the majority, which included Justices Edward Mansfield, Thomas Waterman, Christopher McDonald, and Matthew McDermott. They argued that the rate of absentee ballot requests that have not been fulfilled by county auditors is extremely low, about 13,000 statewide as of Friday, out of more than 842,000 requests. Most of those unfilled are in Johnson and Woodbury counties. Two of the three that had to invalidate pre-filled requests mailed to registered voters. It is of little significance that the law was not passed in response to any instances of absentee ballot fraud since its burdens are so minimal, the majority argued. In a dissent joined by two colleagues, Justice Dana Oxley said that thousands more requests for absentee ballots may come before Saturday's deadline, and those missing information will go unfulfilled. Centro Latino receives $48,000 for pandemic relief fund. Centro Latino of Iowa is among agencies to receive dollars from the Iowa Immigrant Community Fund. The fund initially focused on central Iowa, doling out more than $200,000 to more than 200 immigrant families in the state to help with the impacts of the COVID-19 pandemic, according to release from American Friends Services Committee of Iowa, Al Exito and Proteus Incorporated, all partners on the initiative. An additional $750,000 in funding is now available to families seeking assistance across Iowa through a gift from an anonymous donor. The fund was set up to meet the needs of Iowans who do not qualify for government assistance during the pandemic, a release said. The funds assist community members facing significant challenges due to the loss of income, illness, or other COVID-19 related impacts. That assistance has covered basic needs including rent, mortgages, utilities, transportation, and medicine for individuals and their families during the last few months. Centro Latino Executive Director Ramon Cazelda said the Council Bluffs-based nonprofit received $48,000 from the fund to put toward its COVID-19 Solidarity Relief Fund, which assists local immigrant families. During the pandemic, Centro Latino of Iowa has raised more than $130,000 and helped more than 150 families towards rent, utilities, and medical bills, Calzada said. Families seeking assistance can apply. They can also contact their local partner organization in Southwest Iowa. That's Centro Latino 712-256-6009 to assist in filing out the application. Applications will be processed as they come in by all partners until funding is expended, the release said. The partners on the fund said the $750,000 is focused on farm workers and meat processing families, but additional funds are available for immigrant families who do not meet that component. Here are the faith briefs. Local churches plan in-person online services for Underwood Lutheran Church. Underwood Lutheran Church at 10 3rd Avenue will hold limited Sunday worship opportunities. Indoor worship will be at 8:30 a.m. and education at 9:40 a.m. Outdoor worship will be at 11 a.m., weather permitting, on the church lawn. Reverend Scott Dalen will deliver a sermon based on John 8:31-36 for 5th Avenue United Methodist Church. 5th Avenue United Methodist Church, 1800 Fifth Avenue invites the public to participate in the church's in-person worship service at 9:30 a.m. on Sunday. Social distancing will be practiced and face masks are encouraged but not required. The Sunday worship service will continue to be recorded live and can be viewed on the church's Facebook page. Fifth Avenue UMC Council Bluffs, the church office can be reached Monday and Thursday from 8 a.m. to 2 p.m. at 712-323-734 or through their email faumc@msn.com for prayer or other requests. The church is praying for the community and anyone affected by the virus. For Twin Cities Christian Church, Twin Cities Christian Church, 4220 Gifford Road, welcomes everyone to Sunday's in-person worship and online service at 10:30 a.m. TCCC is handicap accessible. Online services may be accessed on the church's website, twincitiescb.org, on Facebook, and on YouTube. A number of changes have been made to the in-person service to adhere to guidelines for social distancing, sanitations, non-touch greetings, and more that may be viewed on the church's website and on Facebook. For more information, call the church office at 712-366-9112. For St. John Lutheran Church, St. John Lutheran Church, 633 Willow Avenue, holds worship at 5:30 p.m. on Saturdays and 9:30 a.m. on Sundays. Worship will be available to watch on Facebook or YouTube. The church's Facebook page is St. John Lutheran Church, Council Bluffs, IA, and its website is stjohnlca.org. Due to COVID-19, the nursery remains closed for the time being. The building is handicap accessible. Call the church office with any questions at 712-323-7173. Epworth United Methodist Church. Epworth United Methodist Church, 2447 Avenue B, is handicap accessible. Membership is not necessary to participate in any church activities. The church is open for worship at 9:25 a.m. on Sundays, and social distancing will be practiced. Masks are required and are available for those who need one, and the church has plenty of hand sanitizer. Congregants will meet in the fellowship hall due to ease of sanitizing the facility. The weekly sermon will be posted on Facebook by 8:30 a.m. on Sunday. The scripture for this coming Sunday is Matthew 22:34-46. Those who decide not to attend at this time can join in by worshiping at home while we worship at the church. Bible study is held at 10 a.m. Thursdays. We are in prayer for all of those affected by this virus. The church's office hours at 8:30 to 12:30 p.m. Monday through Friday. The church's phone is 712-323-3124. For Our Savers Lutheran Church. Our Savers Lutheran Church, 600 Bluff Street, hold in-person worship services Saturdays at 5:30 and Sundays at 10 a.m. This week, the church will celebrate Reformation Weekend and ask those who attend to wear red. Face masks and social distancing are highly recommended. Worship services will be streamed live Sunday morning at 10 p.m. via the church's Facebook page. Our Savers Lutheran Food and Pet Pantry is open Thursdays from 11 to 3 p.m. The pantry is also open the third and fourth Fridays from 5 to 7. More events and information can be found on the church's website or Facebook page. Your views. Readers voice support for Pelant, discuss Trump and Biden candidacies. Vote for Joe Biden. I first met Joe Biden in Council Bluffs during the run-up to caucus 2004. His knowledge of issues is thorough, and he radiates a commitment to improve the lives of Americans. He authored the Violence Against Women Act 26 years ago. Funding lapsed in December 2019 during the government shutdown, but was quickly restored. Domestic violence still accounts for 21% of violent crime. We can count on Joe to work for safety at home, at work, and in the community. In 1980, the wages of women were 60% of those of men. By 2020, that figure has risen to 80%. However, wages of women of color stagnated at 60%. Joe Biden supports equal pay, investment in women-owned businesses, expanded education and training, and improved pay and benefits for careers where women are the primary workers. We still have much work to do. 75% of women with children, under the age of 18 work outside the home. In two-parent homes, more than half of both parents working. Of course, those are pre-COVID numbers. Currently, women are dropping out of the workforce at a rate four times greater than men to take care of families, supervise schooling, and deal with COVID health crises and restrictions. We all hope to build back and build better, with expanded services for childcare and care of the elderly and those with disabilities. We need paid family leave so that women and men can not only be breadwinners, but also caregivers. Vice President Biden is on our side. Most importantly, we must build on the Affordable Care Act to provide access for health care to all, especially in this era of COVID. Joe Biden supports providing coverage despite pre-existing conditions. He will retain the private option, but also initiate a public option to provide a vital choice for families and individuals. Joe Biden, a man of integrity, is experienced in governance. We need a steady, seasoned professional who will surround himself with experts and programs that are rooted in research and best practice. He is well prepared to address polarization. His long record of bipartisanship and collaboration with Republicans will lead to healing divisions. His experience and expertise in foreign relations will restore the role of America as leader of the free world at this critical time. Please vote for Joe Biden. He has only your best interests and those of your family. Marilyn Kelly, Council Bluffs. Jen Pelant, the right choice for Iowa. If a person is lucky enough, they will enjoy the privilege of knowing two or three people in your life that you would vote for anything. They aren't politicians, but they are so principled and have so much integrity that it doesn't matter what party they are running for. You just vote for them because the world would be a better place with them in office. In my life, I have known two. Dr. Tom Osborne when I lived in Nebraska, and now Jen Pellant. I've known Jen Pellant since our middle school days at Lewis Central. She stands out in my memory because of her gentle treatment of others, her intelligence, and her integrity. As in school, there were expected pecking order based on socioeconomic status, cliques, and ability. There was also the almost obligatory behavior towards kids who didn't meet the ideals of each of those groups or those who that didn't conform to societal trends. Except Jen. She broke that mold. She was a friend to everybody. Perhaps it was because she was so well-rounded. She was an athlete in golf and swimming. She was an academic in National Honor Society and on the honor roll. She was in every advanced class and yet was friends with kids of all classes. She didn't seem to know the lines of division, only the additions of persons. She was a fellow member of the Fellowship of Christian Athletes, whose main goal was to represent the finest Christian tradition of helping everyone, especially those in need. We offered companionship to the elderly in nursing homes, food to the hungry, and support to our developmentally disabled students. Perhaps it was because of her parents, they were both school teachers. Jan Pellant was my 7th grade language arts teacher, who taught me to look beyond the surface to find the truth. Ernie Pellant was my 10th grade arts teacher and football coach, who taught me about respect for everyone, different perspectives, and instinctual fortitude. They both exuded that aura of educators whose integrity and giving to all students was evident and above reproach. Jen carried that same strength, intelligence, and poise in adulthood. Every word and action is a monument to truth and integrity. In this tumultuous year of division and fear, Jen wants to help everyone, just like she always has. Troy Stolp, Council Bluffs. Biden, our best choice for president. I believe Joe Biden represents our best choice for president. FDR created Social Security, LBJ expanded on it to create Medicare. Together, they established a system which moved our country and the well-being of its citizens forward. Our system provides older Americans with health care and income in their golden years, based on what they have contributed during their working years. It's been referred to many as a sacred trust between workers and their government. I grew up in a 4-generation household in Council Bluffs. I experienced what respecting and caring for our elders look like. My grandmother Best, an active community worker, cared for my great-grandmother McConnell. My mother and Walters at Council Bluff Educators provided for my grandmother until shortly before her passing. My sister continued to work as a middle school counselor in Omaha while I took an early retirement from my career as director of the Adult Protective Services in Omaha, and we moved back to care for mother at home until she passed. A common thread in our family story, home, care, health care, and Social Security. Social Security is a lifeline for many and an assist to workers' pensions for others. Medicare provides basic health care, prescriptions, and hospice. That coverage allowed 3 generations of our family to age out at home, just as many older Americans wish and hope to do. Will my sister and I be able to complete the generational cycle in our home? Maybe. President Donald Trump wants to gut our system. He has already delayed payroll taxes that support Social Security, which plans to eliminate them entirely. We must not let that happen. Joe Biden truly cares about working Americans. He grew up in a hard-working neighborhood. Joe understands how Congress works because he served there. He knows what it takes to get legislation passed. He was President Barack Obama's emissary to Congress. Joe Biden has a plan to stabilize and improve Social Security. He has the integrity, experience, and the will to follow through. Please vote for Joe Biden. Our country's future depends on it. Ann Walters, Council Bluff. Look at Trump through a better lens. We look at a picture and see 2 different things, like the Rubin vase. I thought about how Trump has viewed by Democrats and portrayed by the media. You see Trump as a racist. I see him helping blacks with opportunity zones and criminal justice reform. You see Trump building a wall to keep immigrants out. I see him wanting legal immigrants to come in. You see Trump cages at the wall. I see Obama cages at the wall. You see Trump tweets as crude. I see them as responses to a biased media and what Americans are thinking. You see Trump as a selfish putting himself first. I see him as a selfless putting America first. You see Trump alienating your allies. I see him holding them accountable. You see Trump as responsible for 210,000 COVID deaths. I see governors putting many infected patients in their nursing homes. You see Trump not taking COVID serious. I see him closing China travel 10 days after the first case while Pelosi and Cuomo saved your lives. You see taking a knee as a symbol of fighting racism. Trump and I see it disrespecting those who gave their life for America. You see Trump at rallies and call them reckless. I see it as unconditional support because he fights for the people. You see Trump as a foreign policy failure. I see him with 3 Nobel Peace nominations and bringing our troops home. You see looting and rioting in the streets and call it peaceful protest. Trump and I see it as disregarding the rule of law. You see Trump threatening to use National Guard in violent cities as militaristic. I see it as the last resort to save lives and businesses. You see Trump as ignoring science. I see him as trying to balance safety, jobs, livelihood, and mental health. You see Trump and have loathed his every word for 4 years. I see him fighting and standing up for America. You see Trump waving from the balcony of the White House as a dictator. I see him uplifting Commander-in-Chief, giving hope. You see Trump as the worst president. I see him as the best because he promises. Because promises were made were promises kept. You see Trump behind in the polls. I see him winning because he is definitely the people's president. I hope you see what I mean. Craig Boyer, Bayport, New York. How many farmers? I'm interested to learn how many farmers have herd immunity to spread disease through their livestock and are vegetarians who have suggested this plan to their clients to achieve immunity from a disease. There are estimates that using herd immunity, which now seems to be President Donald Trump's healthcare plan, could produce a death toll in the millions out of our 330 million population, according to the Mayo Clinic. Plus, the immunity has been identified as lasting merely up to 4 months. Some have been reinfected. There is so much about this highly contagious disease. Scientists are learning and will continue to change. Lee Hazer, Council Bluffs. You're listening to Council Bluffs Daily Nonpareil for October 23rd on IRIS, the Iowa Radio Reading Information Service for the Blind and Print Handicap in Des Moines. I'm Miles from Drake University. IRIS volunteers love to hear from listeners. If you have any comments or questions about this or any IRIS program, please call toll-free from anywhere in Iowa at 877-404-4747. Thank you. Now we move to the Daily Nonpareil Recent Obituaries for Friday, October 23rd. Mary J. Gruddle, Timothy Oliver Hastings, Cecilia M. Tem Ostemore, Darold Duane Blois, Marilyn Ann Grider. And now we move to sports news. Rashford blown away by grassroots pledges to feed kids. Restaurants, cafes, and even some local governments across England have mounted a grassroots effort inspired by soccer star Marcus Rashford to feed students during the upcoming school break. Pledges to provide free lunches started rolling in after the Manchester United strikers' bid to extend food vouchers over school holidays until Easter was voted down in the House of Commons. The 22-year-old Rashford vowed to continue his fight and was joined by local businesses offering everything from beans on toast to chicken nuggets and fruits. The 22-year-old Rashford vowed to continue his fight and was blown away by news of local businesses stepping up to fill the voucher scheme deficit during the October half term. "Selflessness, kindness, togetherness, this is the England I know," Rashford said. On Friday, the England International fired off a stream of Twitter posts marking the locations of businesses offering their support, and he embedded their social media messages, which urged parents not to feel ashamed to seek help. Many offered to keep requests confidential. Kondoker, an Indian restaurant about 5 miles from Old Trafford, said parents can send a direct message on Twitter. "We don't want any child to go to bed hungry in Manchester. Voting against free school meals for kids in poverty is inhumane. If there are any parents struggling to feed their kids, don't be ashamed. DM us. We'll be happy to put together a hot meal, the restaurant wrote. In June, Rashford successfully lobbied British Prime Minister Boris Johnson's government to extend free school meals through the summer. But on Wednesday, a Labour Party motion backed by the player to extend it again was rejected largely along party lines. More than 1.4 million children benefit from free school meals, according to the Labour Party. English schools are on a break next week. Rashford said families are struggling because of job losses related to the coronavirus pandemic. Britain is among the worst-hit European countries, with almost 44,000 confirmed deaths. The soccer star said he's passionate about the issue because his family relied on free school meals and food banks while growing up in Manchester. Farm Fresh UK in Nottingham said it will provide lunches over the break, consisting of cheese cob or vegan sausage roll and a carton of apple or orange juice. Minikin Paint, a pot art cafe in Manchester, said it will offer a hot baked potato with beans, fruit, snack, and drink to needy kids next week. The local government also pledged support. Hammerston and Fulham Council in London said it would extend the vouchers over the break to ensure 5,000 primary and secondary school pupils don't go hungry. It is also delivering 600 breakfasts to kids each morning. Rashford posted similar statements from councils in Liverpool, Doncaster, and Southwold. Today in sports history, Auburn's Cam Newton sets two rushing records in 2010 win over LSU. Here's a look back at sports happening on this date in history, October 23rd. 1999, Florida State's Bobby Bowden gets 300. 1999, Florida State's Bobby Bowden gets his 300th win with a 17-14 win over his son, Clemson coach Tommy Bowden. In this picture, Clemson coach Tommy Bowden Wright shakes hand with his father, Florida State coach Bobby Bowden, before they started their game Saturday, October 23, 1999, at Memorial Stadium in Clemson, South Carolina. In 2005, La Danaean Tomlinson held to 7 yards rushing, ending record run of 18 straight games with TD. 2005, San Diego's La Danaean Tomlinson is held to a career low 7 yards rushing on 17 carries and fails to score in the Chargers' 2017 loss at Philadelphia, ending his NFL record-tying streak of games with a touchdown at 18. In 2008, Brandon Sutter becomes ninth member of family to play in NHL. 2008, Carolina's Brandon Sutter gives one of hockey's most famous families another milestone, scoring his first NHL goal in a 4-1 loss at Pittsburgh. The 19-year-old Sutter, son of New Jersey Devils coach Brett Sutter, is the ninth member of the Sutter family to play in the NHL. In 2010, Auburn's Cam Newton sets two records in win over LSU. 2010. Auburn's Cam Newton sets two records in the Tigers' 24-17 win over LSU. He breaks the SEC's single-season rushing mark for a quarterback of 1,006 yards in Auburn's Jimmy Siddle in 1963, and tops Heisman winner Pat Sullivan's 40-year-old school mark at 26 TD rushing and passing in a season. In 2011, Tim Tebow rallies Broncos past Dolphins in closing minutes. 2011, Tim Tebow rallies the Broncos for two touchdowns in the final 2:44 of the fourth quarter to force overtime, and Matt Prater's 52-yard field goal gives Denver an improbable 18-15 victory over the stunned Miami Dolphins. In 2011, Saints' Drew Brees throws five TDs in 6-2-7 win over Colts. 2011, Drew Brees completes 31 of 35 passes for 325 yards and 5 touchdowns, and the Saints set a franchise record for points in victory margin in a 62-7 against the hapless Indianapolis Colts. 2016, Adam Vinatieri sets NFL record for 43 consecutive field goal. 2006, Adam Vinatieri kicks a pair of field goals in Indianapolis' 34-26 victory over Tennessee to give him an NFL record, 43 consecutive field goals made. his first ties him with the former Colts kicker, Mike Vanderjagt, who made 42 straight between 2002 and 2004. In 2016, Jay Ajayi ties an NFL record with back-to-back 200-yard rushing games for Dolphins. Jay Ajayi ties an NFL record by surpassing 200 yards rushing for the second game in a row, helping the Miami Dolphins rally past the Buffalo Bills 28-25. Ajayi rushes for 214 yards in 29 carries after totaling 204 yards a week earlier in a win over Pittsburgh. Conflict raging over the eyes of Texas school song. Austin, Texas, losing football games is one thing at the University of Texas. A challenge to the hallowed school song is quite another. A controversy over the eyes of Texas has lingered for weeks now at Texas, with some players refusing to sing it after games or even stand for it given its links to the racist minstrel shows of yesteryear. Just this week, the highly respected Longhorn Band reportedly has refused to play the song, whose history at Texas dates to the early 1900s. The administration insists the song, one of the school's most treasured traditions, will stay even though it is unlikely that players or student musicians can be ordered to support it. Standing for the eyes of Texas is a statement of something: school spirit, loyalty, solidarity, University of Texas law professor Emeritus David Anderson said. But deliberately not standing or leaving the field is a statement just as surely. It's protected speech. Written in 1903 and sung to the tune of I've Been Working on the Railroad, the song is an old standard in Longhorn County and country. For decades, it has been sung after games and graduation ceremonies and is a popular sing-along at weddings and even funerals. The song has been a sore subject for minority students for decades. The title is taken from a favored saying of a former school president who had mimicked remarks by Confederate Gen. Robert E. Lee. The song was routinely performed by musicians in blackface at minstrel shows. Amid the racial injustice protests that rocked the nation this year, Texas athletes were among the most prominent college sports figures to join demonstrations after the death of George Floyd. They marched with the coach Tom Herman from campus to the state capitol, then led a group of students and athletes demanding the school drop the eyes of Texas. Letters to the school president, athletic director, and board of regents poured in wanting to keep the song. Some urged thoughtful consideration. Others dismissed the demand from agitators and whiners who just want to create trouble. Texas officials kept the song, but the players, they would not be required to sing it. A special committee was created to study and present its full history. But the issue flared again when the football team didn't stay on the field for the song after the first two home games of the season. Fan resentment exploded 2 weeks ago when most of the players left the field again after the annual Texas-Oklahoma game in Dallas. That prompted athletic director Chris DeConte to say that he expects Longhorns team to stand in unison during the song. He met with the football team to discuss it. Tyler Valeska of the First Amendment Clinic at the Cornell Law School said Texas would be limited in any attempts to force players to sing or stay on the field for a song they don't support. It's irrelevant whether the general public would not find it controversial. One value the First Amendment protects is dissent, Valeska said. We don't want the government telling people what something means to them and for what reasons. The Daily Texan campus newspaper reported Wednesday that the large numbers of Longhorn band members now refuse to play the song. Band director Scott Hanna did not immediately respond to a request for comment. The band was not slated to play during this weekend's home game against Baylor, the school said. Even without the band, Texas President Jay Hartzell said the eyes of Texas will still be played at games and events while the school looks for ways to join together around our song, which has been so positive for so many Longhorns for over the past 120 years. The Board of Regents Chairman Kevin Elieft backed him up on Thursday. To be clear, the UT System Board of Regents stands unequivocally and unanonymously in support of President Hartzell's announcement that the Eyes of Texas is and will remain the official school song, Elieft said. Tasha Pilfot, a government professor affiliated with the school Center of African and African American Studies, said the messages from the administration confuse and put pressure on athletes who were just told a few months ago they didn't have to participate. It gave them a lot of agency that they hadn't experienced before, Pilfot said. now, coming back and telling them not to exercise that voice is almost a way of silencing them. Herman, the football coach, the volleyball coach, Jerry at Elliott, insisted this week there is no mandate for athletes to participate. When you are a young person, when you want to stand for something, it's really easy to dig your feet in the ground pretty early and say, "This is my stance," Elliott said. "The biggest mistakes I could make as a leader is going there and say, we're going to mandate this." Football player Taquan Graham, who is black, and said he doesn't think that his teammates worry about their status on the team depending on supporting the song. He plans to stay on the field for the song on Saturday. "I'm going to support my teammates, and I'm going to give my thanks for the fans because that's what they deserve," Graham said. "And that's all I can speak on. I can't speak for everyone else." Quarterback Sam Ellinger, who is white, and he's told his teammates why the song is important to him. Ellinger and Graham, the only two players to meet with reporters this week, said the issue hasn't divided them. "I grew up in Longhorn," Ellinger said. "I grew up singing in the Eyes of Texas, win, lose, or draw. And I've shared my experience with my family, and I've shared the experiences with my late dad. Never once singing that song has anything negative crossed my mind." "Taking a stand against a school as large and powerful as Texas requires courage," said Jesse Chopper. Former dean of the University of California, Berkeley Law School, and professor emeritus. He compared it to the former NFL quarterback Colin Kaepernick taking a knee during the national anthem. "It cost him plenty. He's still trying to recover his career," Chopper said. "You have to find somebody with a lot of guts." Morton expected to start for Tampa Bay against Los Angeles. Los Angeles Dodgers, 43-17, first in the NL West, versus Tampa Bay Rays, 40-20, first in the AL East. Arlington, Texas, Friday, 8:08 p.m. EDT. Pitching probables. Los Angeles, Walker Buehler, 1-0, 3.44 ERA in regular season. Tampa Bay, Charlie Morton, 2-2, 4.74 ERA in regular season. Line. Dodgers favored by 1.5 runs, over under is 7.5 runs. World Series tied 1-1. Bottom line, Tampa and Los Angeles will meet on Friday. The Rays were 29 in home games in 2020. Tampa Bay has a team on base percentage of .294 this postseason. Randy Arozarena leads them with an OBP of .435, including 11 extra base hits and 10 RBIs. The Dodgers posted a record of 22-8 away from the home in 2020. Los Angeles has a team on base percentage of .353 this postseason. Max Muncy leads them with an OBP of .435, including 6 extra base hits and 10 RBIs. Regular season top performers. Brandon Lowe leads the Rays with 37 RBIs and is batting .269. Corey Seager leads the Dodgers with 28 extra base hits, and is slugging .585. Last 10 games, Rays 8-2, .233 batting average, 2.72 ERA, outscored opponents by 15 runs. Dodgers 8-2, .276 batting average, 3.14 ERA, outscored opponents by 34 runs. Injuries, Rays, Chaz Rowe, elbow, Cody Reed, finger, Colin Polk, elbow, Andrew Kittredge, elbow, Yanni Chinaros, elbow, Jalene Beeks, elbow. Dodgers, Jimmy Nelson, back, Caleb Ferguson, left elbow. And now one story from the entertainment section. NBC's Welker Sharp in first turn as debate moderator. New York AP moderator Kristen Welker, with the help of an offstage mute button, helped give Americans the substantive, crackling debate over leadership that has been missing so far during the 2020 presidential campaign. The NBC News White House correspondent worked hard Thursday to keep control of the second and final encounter between President Donald Trump and Democrat Joe Biden, steering but not stifling changes. Midway through the debate, she even received a compliment from the Republican president, who said, "So far, I respect very much the way you handled this." Welker also benefited from a different Trump, who resisted the interruptions that spoiled his first debate with Biden. The second was canceled when Trump objected to a virtual format after he caught COVID-19, replaced by dueling town hall meetings that satisfied nobody. I'm jealous, said Fox News Channel's Chris Wallace, moderator of the first debate. I would have loved to have been able to moderate the debate and get a real exchange of views instead of 100 of interruptions. Shortly before Thursday's encounter, the debate commission said it would shut off the microphone of a candidate to give his opponent a chance to get through a two-minute answer when a new subject was introduced. It seemed to work, mostly as a deterrent. Neither candidate tried to shout through the silence. When the candidates were allowed more directly engage, Wecker was generally successful in striking the balance between giving them room and cutting off the discussion when it became unproductive. 10 seconds, Mr. President, then I have to move on, she said during a healthcare discussion. She was attuned to the news, asking Trump how he would reunite families separated at the southern border following the revelation that the government had lost track of parents of hundreds of children. She twice followed up when the president didn't directly address the question. Wecker had a sharp retort to Trump when he dodged a question on why the government had failed to agree on a new stimulus package for families suffering financially from the coronavirus. Because Nancy Pelosi doesn't want to approve it, he said. But you're the president, Walker replied. Walker asked Biden to directly address Americans who feared that his approach to health care would mean too much government involvement and to square his desire to improve the environment without harming the economy. She also didn't shy away from recent stories about Biden's son Hunter's involvement in foreign companies and allegations that he took advantage of his father's role as vice president. Somewhat oddly, it was Biden who first brought it up by criticizing Trump's lawyer, Rudolph Giuliani. Was there anything about these relationships that was inappropriate or unethical, Wecker asked. Similarly, in talking about recent reports of a Trump bank account in China, she asked the president, how can voters know that you don't have any conflicts of interest? Wecker, a 44-year-old Harvard graduate who was the first black woman to moderate a presidential debate since 1992, asked the candidates in personal terms what they would say to minorities who felt they had to prepare their children for the possibility that law enforcement could target them for the color of their skin. Some conservatives said on social media that they believed Wecker was quicker to cut Trump off than Biden and introduce subjects. The coronavirus, race, and climate change that helped the Democrat. But she received praise for her performance from across the political spectrum, including conservative personalities Ben Shapiro and Britt Hume. Kristen Wecker is putting on a masterclass on how to moderate a presidential debate, tweeted Philip Rucker, a Washington Post reporter. And that brings us to the end of today's reading of the Council Bluffs Daily Nonpareil for October 23rd. The Nonpareil can be heard each weekday at 3 p.m. Iris volunteers love to hear from listeners. If you have any comments or questions about today's broadcast or any Iris program, please call toll-free from anywhere in Iowa at 877-404-4747. I'm Miles from Drake University in Des Moines. Thank you for listening.
This is Jim Ralston, and I'm with IRIS, Short Take from the Iowa Curiosities. Farmers and their toys, Dyersville, Iowa. The wisdom on bumper stickers is true. And those with the most toys truly do win. Then the National Farm Toy Museum in Dyersville is a winner many times over, with two floors of more than 30,000 farm toys and exhibits, ranging from row after row of common tractors to combines, harvesters, and haulers, all the way down the extensive agricultural machinery lineup to an anhydrous ammonia tanker. The museum is a shrine and miniature to the heavy equipment Iowa farmers fuss over, endlessly fix, periodically live in during planting or harvesting, and tirelessly operate to bring home the grain or the beans that bring home the bacon. And don't let the word toy fool you. The only thing toy-like about these farm toys is that they are built to 1/16th or 1/32nd scale, and don't have internal combustion engines. This is Iowa, after all. Farm machines aren't child's play, even when they're toys. Most of the toys are stunningly accurate, not to mention beautiful. Replicas of tractors or combines with particular makers like John Deere and Case, from particular years, with details accurate down to the windshield wipers. Children play with these toys not only to have fun, they got a vocational education and heavy equipment. Highlights of the museum include an exhibit explaining the notion of scale that features a full-size replica of a John Deere tractor accompanied by a row of successfully smaller scale models, from 1/2 scale all the way down to a realistically looking tractor you can carry in your pocket. Upstairs, look for more tractors and harvesters, enclosed in glass cases, more perhaps than you've ever hoped to see. And though the word toy does technically appear in this museum's name, don't expect much playing around. Tractors, trucks, trailers, and combines, even at 1/32nd or 1/64 scale, are way too wrapped up in Iowa's blood, sweat, and sorrow to be simple objects of play. Don't be surprised if you see some old-timer kicking the tires of a tiny Case combine, wondering how it would hold up harvesting more than 2,000 acres. Or some young, unquietly cussing pocket-sized John Deere because it won't turn over. The National Farm Toy Museum is at the intersection of US 20 and Iowa Highway 136 in Dyersville. Open daily from 6 a.m. to 6 p.m., the museum also hosts a number of special events. Exhibits throughout the year, the largest of which is the granddaddy of all farm toy shows, held the first full weekend in November. For more information, call 563-875-2727 or visit www.nationalfarmtoymuseum.com. That was an excerpt from Iowa Curiosities, Quirky Characters, Roadside Oddities, and Other Offbeat Stuff by Eric Jones, Dan Coffey, and Barrett Thorkelson.